140 years since the city council has been put in, we've never had a deaf person run. So right. I'm the first one in, you know, to do that. And I'm just thrilled for the opportunity to see the way that we can make the change happen through just the representation.
Yeah, we could have, sorry, you go.
No, sorry. I mean, we're down to less than a minute now. I haven't seen anybody peeking through the window for the next show, but they do that. No, I was just going to say that, you know, the people might not be tying it together right now. How does this fit into labor? But one of the one of the most important things for labor is political activism.
Yep.
So if you're out there listening, you got some soul searching to do. You got to think about what policies and what representatives you want that are going to legislate for your needs at work. Who's going to get you more paid sick time? Who's going to get you more, you know, time off
to
live
your
life and spend time with your family, you know, while, you know. We all have a limited amount of time.
Yeah.
So if people have any questions, if people want to know more and they like what they've heard, how can they reach out and get a hold of you, and how can they support your cause?
Yep.
Yeah, so I do have a website, www.philip4portland2018.com, and that's Philip, P-H-I-L-I-P. So you can go ahead and click into any of the issues and goals that I have. I have both written and videos that are up there for people to watch. I give a sort of background of my experience and who I've been and who I am now and how Portland has changed me. And so I've just been trying to reach out with people on the ground and meet people face to face. Really, I'm here for everyone. I'm looking forward to hearing voices and seeing how I can represent people. So thank you for listening to me and thank you for listening to us.
Well, thank you for being
here. Thank you very much for being on the show, everyone. This has been Philip Wolf. And
I'm Michael Cathcart.
I'm Nick Bubb, and this has been Labor Radio. Coming up next, stay tuned. You don't want to miss Prison Pipeline.
Yes, indeed. Have a great night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Good evening and welcome to Prison Pipeline. Today on Prison Pipeline, we have Kelly Simon from the ACLU. And we're going to be talking today about the case of Michelle Wright and the status of transgender prisoners in the state of Oregon. Welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thanks, Emma. It's exciting to be here.
Thank you. So let's jump right into this. Let's talk first of all about the case of Michelle Wright. There was a press release that came out last month that said that a big victory had happened for Michelle Wright. She's a prisoner in ODOC. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, so our client, Michelle Wright, is a transgender woman who's been incarcerated at various men's prisons in Oregon since 2013, kind of late 2013. And what's true, what we've seen to be true for a number of our transgender and gender nonconforming friends and family, particularly transgender women of color, was true of Michelle. And what I mean by that is that high poverty levels, lack of access to healthcare, societal rejection, and frankly, outright discrimination disproportionately swept her and sweeps others up into our criminal justice system. So Michelle was in and out of homelessness, was battling a drug addiction that grew out of the rejection and violence she had experienced in our community, and ended up in the custody of the Oregon Department of Corrections.
Was she in for a Measure 11 offense?
It was an attempted robbery one, so I do not believe that is Measure 11.
Okay. So Michelle ended up in ODOC in 2013?
That's right.
And when she went into ODOC, did she say at that time that she was transgender?
You know, she didn't. She had started to kind of come out prior to her incarceration, but had not had an opportunity yet to start on any healthcare kind of regimens prior to entering. And as I think any of us could understand, prison is a very intimidating, scary place. And she wasn't quite ready to be that vulnerable when she entered Oregon Department of Corrections. But by the end of 2014, she had come out to some of her healthcare providers, and she had begun to ask for hormone therapy, and she was repeatedly denied those requests.
So Michelle came into prison, got put in a men's prison. It's not unusual for someone to come out in prison. I mean, there's so many cases that we could talk about, but she's coming out in prison. And I guess, what was the policy of ODOC at the time when she began to request hormones and began to talk about, you know, with her medical providers that she felt she was transgender?
Yeah, so we started an investigation once we got in contact with folks like Michelle and a couple other women in the men's facilities. And so we didn't see a policy on paper, but the very, very, very similar pattern that we saw in the story of, I think it was over 20 women that we talked to in our investigation, was that if you hadn't started on hormones prior to coming into prison, that care was simply unavailable to you while you were incarcerated.
So the policy of ODOC at that time was that if you hadn't begun to medically transition before you were incarcerated, then you were simply put into the gender that ODOC assigned you to. So if ODOC decided you were male, they stuck you in a male prison. If they decide you were female, they stuck you in a female prison.
That's right. That's how I understand it was.
Okay. Is that still the policy?
You know, we are aware of some women who are now being housed in Coffee Creek. It's still unclear to me how those decisions are being made. Based on the, you know, my limited exposure to just talking to people who get in contact with the ACLU who are incarcerated, is if you have had a surgical intervention of some sort or have gone through any sort of surgical transition process, then you will potentially be allowed. And I say potentially because I actually don't know if that's true for every case. But we have seen some women appropriately housed at Coffee Creek. Mm-hmm. But it's still less than clear to me how those decisions are being made.
Okay, we'll get back to that in a minute.
Yeah, sure.
So let's get back to Michelle. So Michelle had started to come out to some medical providers, and then somehow, why did she get in touch with the ACLU? How did that happen?
Yeah, you know, we started hearing from a couple of women in the Department of Corrections, and I actually believe the first one got in touch with Basic Rights Oregon, and they referred her over to us. And just kind of by word of mouth, more and more women began to know to turn to the ACLU and to share their story about the cruel treatment that they were having to endure.
And what are some examples of the cruel treatment that they had to endure?
Well, first and foremost, the just flat-out denial of necessary care. That is a clear violation of the Eighth Amendment. And so when you think of the legal concept of cruel and unusual treatment that's prohibited by our Constitution, that is clear, not only a clear kind of violation of the Constitution, but also it was a clear pattern that we were seeing that these women were having to endure. And other things that Michelle had to go through, she, because she was willing to kind of fight back against the system and demand the care that she needed, she faced a lot of retaliation. Officers targeted her for just really nasty treatment, things like telling her to man up, calling her an effing freak, other just really vulgar, offensive comments. It was just gross.
Mm-hmm. Well, so 2013-2014, was Michelle allowed access to hormones or to any kind of transition-related services while she was in ODOC? Where was she at the CRC?
She was, at the time we got in touch with her, she was at Snake River, okay. Correctional Institution, so out in Eastern Oregon. And no, she had no care available to her whatsoever, and continued to be denied that same care for years, until we got involved in 2016 and began making demands on her behalf. And by the time we filed the lawsuit, kind of later in 2016, she had made nearly 100 requests for treatment that were repeatedly denied. She had attempted suicide several times and attempted self-castration a number of times. And you know, we started negotiating with DOC early 2016 to try to see if we could just advocate less formally for changes. And frankly, got a lot of lip service. And we realized, you know, it's well and good to have good intentions and set your sights toward change, but you know, all the while we're talking about potential changes that could happen, people are suffering, and Michelle was really suffering, and so we decided we needed to file a lawsuit on her behalf to finally put an end to the cruel treatment that she and others were facing.
So you had over 100 documented requests from Michelle for gender appropriate services that were denied.
That's right. And the structure of how those decisions are made, there's a committee that sits in Salem. Any request that's made has to go through that committee. They have, you know, they were supposed to be a multidisciplinary committee, and they look at the file and they say yay or nay. But what we consistently saw with every woman that we talked to was, despite every one of them having a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, every single one of them was also being just told no.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any, did the state release any kind of reasoning for its decision? Did it, in the process of filing lawsuit on behalf of Michelle, did the state provide rationale for the denial of services?
The state continued to say these decisions are made on a case-by-case basis, and at this time we don't see kind of a medical need. And this medical need is kind of this legal standard that, mm-hmm. that I think they are well aware of that they need to meet. But what courts have made clear is that this is medically necessary care, and when it's denied, it violates the Eighth Amendment.
So the state was making the denial on the basis of medical necessity, and that was one of the primary primary factors in filing the lawsuit, was to overrule that claim?
Yeah, I think, you know, that was the heart of our claim, is to deny this medically necessary care is cruel and unusual treatment. And I think, you know, now looking at the settlement, the state is saying this care is medically necessary, and I think they finally realized that they were just wrong.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, we'll get to the resolution in just a minute, but do you think that filing a lawsuit has resulted in a greater impact than just this particular case? Do you think that it has, like, had an impact across the entire system, the whole ODOC system?
I do. I am very helpful. I think in a lot of ways, not only is this a huge victory for Michelle, but it's a huge victory for all transgender prisoners in Oregon that have, you know, far too long been having to endure this cruel treatment. The settlement commits the state to a number of significant policy changes relating to the treatment of transgender and gender nonconforming prisoners. That includes access to doctors with experience caring for transgender people, competent mental health care, hormone therapy, and if medically necessary, gender confirmation surgery. And these are just things that just weren't on the table a year ago, frankly. So I'm hopeful that we've made some progress already and that there is more progress to be made moving forward.
That's great. So one of the things you said was that Michelle had attempted suicide several times. Was that because of being denied medical care? And what was the outcome of those suicide attempts?
It was because of the denial of care and the just cruel treatment that she was suffering day to day, both from guards and inmates. In terms of the outcome, I think Luckily, Michelle continues to be a survivor, and I really admire her strength in not only advocating for herself, but advocating for others in this case.
Now, someone that I saw a lot in this case, tracking it in the media, was Victoria Wright, Michelle's mother. Can you tell me what role Victoria played in this case?
Yeah, you know, I think for anyone who is living inside of a prison, it's always so helpful to have positive family support and people who you can turn to when things feel unbearable. And I think in a lot of moments, Michelle felt like things were unbearable, but she had people to talk to and people who loved her and cared for her. So I definitely think Victoria played an important role for Michelle too.
And for the legal team at the ACLU, what was your role in the case particularly?
Yeah, you know, we had a team of five lawyers, three who were volunteers, and all three worked for the law firm Stoll Reeves. And I should give them a shout out. Ed Reeves, Kenan Scott, and Samantha Sondag all put in a tremendous amount of work on this case. And then it was our legal director, Matt Dos Santos, and I working on the case. So
over at Basic Rights Oregon?
Matt is at ACLU of Oregon.
Okay, gotcha.
Yep. He is our legal director and has a significant amount of experience litigating these cases. So I definitely learned a lot from him and from the Stoll Reeves attorneys that were involved. But yeah, I think for all of us, it was a very intensive kind of investigation period, trying to connect with women and learn about their experiences. And then kind of all the lawyerly things that it go into a case. We were all very involved in.
So the population, in ODOC, I don't remember the raw numbers. I know over at Coffee Creek, there's about 3,000. And I think like in all of ODOC, there's like maybe 31,000, something like that. But I'm wondering, do you have any idea how many people who are in ODOC right now might be considered transgender or might be seeking services as transgendered individuals?
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen any statistics around that, but I know when we completed our investigation, we had talked to over 20 women and one man. And I know I have since been in touch with a few more folks who are new. Some have come out of prison since then. So I really am not sure. I know I don't know everyone there either. Mm-hmm. So it is certainly not always easy to communicate with folks on the inside. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure.
One of the things that I think a lot of trans people hear about, and maybe it's just a myth, maybe it's true, I don't know, but is that solitary is used often for trans prisoners as a way of, you know, basically dealing with the problem mm-hmm. of having a trans prisoner. I mean, they'll just be put in the shoe and they'll be told that it's, you know, this is for your safety, or, you know, maybe there'll be a problem. They'll say there's a problem with the prisoner or whatever. Can you comment on that? Is this something that came up in your case at all with Michelle Wright? And what have you heard about this?
Yeah, I think one thing that was really alarming for us was the amount of time Michelle had spent in solitary throughout the only a few years that she had been there. And I think if you were to add up the numbers, I may get this slightly off, but I want to say, you know, to date, she's probably been in there about 500 to 600 days of her entire stay. And
that's only that's only 4 years into her sentence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So
almost half of
the half the time, right? Yeah. That to me, though, of course, I don't think ODOC nor any of its employees would admit that there was any sort of targeting going on. That to me is alarming, and I find it hard to believe that there is not a more systemic issue going on there, and because her story is not unique either. And I think moving forward, you know, that's really an issue that will need to be tackled, and how we do that, I think, is still to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about Michelle. Have you met her? Have you worked with her?
I have met Michelle.
What's she like?
She is extremely intelligent. She is committed to making the Department of Corrections a more humane place, not only for her, but for others. And she's committed to being healthy. She takes her healthcare very seriously. She likes to be involved in her healthcare decisions. You know, I think in the Department of Corrections or in prisons, it's your care is kind of doled out to you in the way that the institution sees fit. But she's committed to seeing that process be more like healthcare rather than part of, you know, some sort of sentence or something that you get. So yeah, she is an incredible woman. She really cares about people, and she cares about herself, and she cares about making this institution better.
So we were talking a little bit before the show, and I was asking you about how does ODOC make a determination? I know that we've both agreed that it's not really clear yet, but there is some kind of process. Can you talk a little bit about the process, like the committees or the boards or whoever makes these decisions?
Yeah, and can you just clarify which decisions you're referring to?
Okay, sure. So, like, let's say someone comes, to their whoever's supervising them at the time, and they say, or their healthcare provider, and they say they're transgender. How does ODOC come to a determination about proper placement of the individual, about appropriate medical treatment, all of those kinds of decisions? Talk me through the process.
Yeah. So there's kind of two separate processes for the things you just flagged there. On the medical side, the process that's been in place clearly wasn't working. And so part of what the settlement does is commit the Department of Corrections to providing new rules and protocol, medical rules and protocols. They have to provide a draft to the ACLU and Basic Rights Oregon by January 15th of next year, and then have to let us meaningfully kind of confer with them on what that should look like. So I think the process is less than clear now and in transition. And so we will see kind of early next year where it looks like they will head with the medical side of things. On the placement side of things, we know there is a committee called the TAIC that makes these.
And what does that acronym stand for?
It stands for the Transgender and Intersex Committee. They are responsible. Again, it's another multidisciplinary team. They're responsible for making placement decisions. One thing, so Michelle is still in a men's facility. One thing that the settlement agreement secures for her is a 2-month review of that placement. So every 2 months, this committee will review Michelle's placement. And what we tried to make clear in the settlement language was that needed to be based on legitimate security and health concerns, not her biological sex assigned to her at birth, and not her genitalia. And I think that's the kind of standard that applies not just to Michelle though, but to everyone.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that TAIC?
That's right.
How do you think they'll come to determinations about placement of individuals? I mean, to me, that's like one of the most significant things. I mean, I'm a trans woman, and I go to Coffee Creek all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm post-op, but I mean, that doesn't matter I go to Coffee Creek. I'm a woman. I go to Coffee Creek. I'm not incarcerated. I'm a volunteer. Mm-hmm. But still, I mean, women should go to women's prisons if that's how they identify. So what will it take to get the TAIC to send Michelle and anyone who identifies as a woman to a women's prison? I mean, what are some of the concerns that they would have?
Yeah, I think the difficult thing about trying to understand and think about progress for the TAIC is that we don't really know how they're making their decisions. So, Michelle's first review was this month, and she was denied that transfer. But we haven't seen a written explanation, for example, of what factors were relied on or what parts of their decision making leaned one way or another. So I do think we need more transparency, or at least individuals who are affected by those decisions need more transparency in how those decisions are being made. Because again, if the decision does not take into account the health and safety of an individual's needs, then that's really concerning to us.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand the idea that it's also important, though, to be sensitive to the person who's incarcerated and what their request is.
Right.
You know, because before we started, we were chatting, and I just talked about the case of Lynn Bennett, mm-hmm. who was arrested for murdering his ex-wife back in 2010 or 2009 in Gladstone. And he finally got sentenced, I think it was last year, and he's been placed in a Coffee Creek, which, you know, was, I think, my understanding is that was in part like his request was to go to Coffee Creek. And having volunteered at Coffee Creek too, I know that there's a lot of people who identify as transmasculine who are at Coffee Creek. And I don't know the details as to every person who's there, like mm-hmm. why do they want to be at Coffee Creek instead of the CRC? But I can imagine that there are a lot of concerns. I mean, if you've been inside of a prison, you know, you know, I mean, you might want to be, even if you're a transmasculine, you might want to be at Coffee Creek instead of the CRC. I mean, just based on reality. But, you know, it should be up to the person, shouldn't it?
Well, I think that individuals should definitely have a say in their treatment and their care and how, you know, they're being held. Mm-hmm. You know, I would just reiterate that really these decisions can't be about these kind of factors that I mentioned of biological, you know, assigned sex and in mm-hmm. external genitalia, the presence of any particular genitalia. They really need to be about health and safety, and I think that's at the heart of it. And if someone is feeling safer in one place, then I think we need to take that very seriously.
I mean, I think part of it too, like, we're getting into more about like prison culture and not so much about trans issues, but I mean, it really is part of the conversation. I mean, I think that if you're a trans man, you know, going into the system through ODOC, I think you're facing a different kind of reality than if you're a trans woman going into ODOC. You know, for one thing, 93% of all the people incarcerated in the state of Oregon are, you know, identified as masculine, and only 7% are identified as feminine. Mm. So part of it is like where the resources go, but also it's like the kind of cultures that evolve in like each prison are different. So like, I mean, the CRC is really different from Coffee Creek, and Snake River is especially really different from Coffee Creek. I mean, there's just a really different kind of culture there. And I think that plays a role in, or that should play a role in, you know, what kind of decisions people make. But it shouldn't be based on, you know, some biological essentialism that's like argued by, you know, some antiquated 19th century idea about what gender is. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, you mentioned wanting to kind of think about, well, what's next for Oregon? And I think this culture piece is really key. You know, it's good that we have some of these commitments on paper, but in order to meaningfully implement things that we secured in this settlement, for example, we have a new staff directive to treat transgender people with dignity and respect. And it's longer than that, but you know, for Michelle, if folks repeatedly violate this staff directive, she can go back to the judge and say, "Judge, I think that this settlement agreement is not being adhered to." But for others, we really need to engage in meaningful training and meaningful attempts at culture shifting within kind of the inside each individual institution, because it's nice that Salem is committed to certain things, but that doesn't automatically translate, especially to folks living in the Eastern Oregon facilities. You know, we're still hearing issues from women who are getting disciplined for wearing their hair in a ponytail, and things like this. So we do really need to take into account the culture of our institutions and see how we can start to shift that.
Well, we're just about out of time. Can you give us any last words? What's up next for Michelle? Where can people go if they want to find out more information, especially if they're like trans-identified? How can they get in touch with you, or how can they get in touch with some organization that might advocate for their interests?
Yeah, so Michelle will be continuing to work with us to ensure that the promises of this agreement are brought to fruition. I think for folks out there who want to get involved or have a story to share, I would encourage you to contact both the ACLU of Oregon and Basic Rights Oregon, as we will be working with the state agency to be the leader that they claim they want to be. For ACLU of Oregon, our website is www.aclu-or.org, and we have a legal request form there. Or you can email us at info@aclu-or.org. Basic Rights Oregon, I don't know their contact information by heart, but they, if you Google Basic Rights Oregon, I'm sure their website will pop right up. They're great allies and partners.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Emma,
and thanks for being on Prison Pipeline. And hopefully this case with Michelle will turn out really good, and she'll get transferred to Coffee Creek and, you know, be someplace that's gender appropriate for her.
Thanks so much, Emma. I really appreciate you having us.
Thank you. Good night.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2017 Iconic Music Party, Thursday, November 30th at 8 p.m. at the 6 West Lounge in Vancouver, Washington. Performing at this year's Iconic Music Party will be the True Original Beings, C4 The Prodigy, MC Grown, Mike Crenshaw,